So today what we're going to go through is we'll get partially through one other church and the rewards that Christ talks about there. And so we're going to go through a part of the way, and then we're going to kind of take a diversion, and then we'll finish up that one of the rewards that the church is given next time. So we went through and we looked at the rewards that were given, were offered to the church in Ephesus, and we looked at the tree of life and the paradise of God. And so as we begin overcoming and God begins to work in our lives, then God opens the way for us to enjoy those blessings and benefits. And in the ultimate sense, we will enjoy them in the world to come. So in so we're going to pick up with the second church here that Christ speaks to in Revelation chapter 2, verse 8. And he speaks to the church in Smyrna. And the church in Smyrna is quite interesting. He doesn't have a lot of criticism for the church in Smyrna, but it's kind of scary what he has to say to that church. Revelation chapter 2, verse 8, it says, "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna," that is the angel or messenger, could be an angelic being, could be someone who was a messenger to the church. And it says, "These things says the first and the last, who was dead and came to life." Speaking of Jesus Christ, "I know your works." So God not only knows the works of a particular church, but each of us as individuals. He says, "I know your works, tribulation and poverty." So this church had works, and he saw that they had suffered tribulation and poverty. So physically speaking, he says that they were poverty stricken. So from a physical, as you looked at this particular church, it was not a well-to-do church. It was a church that suffered poverty. But he tells them, "You are rich." And when he says you're rich, he's not speaking about their pocketbooks or where they lived. He's saying you are rich in a spiritual sense. Now, God observed these people and he saw that they were a humble people, a people that were not rich in the world's goods, but they were rich toward God. And that's really what counts. He says, "I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not." There are, as you look at that, there are people that, if you were to look at the Jews themselves in the time of Christ, all of those who sought Christ's death, all of those who rejected Jesus Christ, if you were to ask them if they were Jews, they would all say they were. They were all Jews in an ethnic sense. But a Jew in a spiritual sense would be one who was seeking to follow God and to live by every word of God, and unfortunately these individuals were not, and yet they told other people that they were Jews, and they are not. And so what does that have to do with us? There are people who call themselves Christians, but they are not. You have to look at this as the Jews were God's people. The Jews were God's people, but the way that they weren't living by the scriptures and they were not following God, and as a result of that, the Jews may have been at one time God's called out people, but they had rejected God and they still called themselves Jews, the true representatives of God, and they were not. And by this time, in the time of the Apostle John, there were people that said they were Jews, and in fact were not, people that said they were Christians, and in fact they were not. And we still live in a time where people say they are Christians when, in fact, they are not. They are a synagogue of Satan. A synagogue is a place where people congregate to worship God. And these individuals were, in fact, not pursuing God. They were living apart from God, and yet they conveyed themselves as being Christian. They were a synagogue of Satan. Satan was the dominant force. And he says, "Do not fear those things which are about you are about to suffer." So before it ever happened, Christ is telling them, you are going to suffer. He's telling them, it's coming. Don't fear it. Do not fear those things which you are about to suffer. And just imagine somebody tells you that. What are you going to do? I'm going to be worried about it. Are you? You know, what's coming? What do you mean? Okay, what do you mean by suffering? You know, how far is this going to go? And but he tells them, don't fear those things which you are about to suffer. So he says, you need to keep your mind fixed where your riches are. Where do your riches come from? They come from me. Keep your mind focused there and don't be deterred from that, because suffering is coming your way. Suffering is coming your way. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison. So for some of you, because of the faith, you are going to be thrown into prison. So he's telling them, some of you in the congregation in Smyrna are going to be thrown into prison. That's coming. Be aware that it's coming, that you may be tested. All of this is to take place in order to test them, to find out whether they are in the faith and whether they are going to hold fast to the faith, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. So is this a 10-day period? Don't know, but they're going to suffer tribulation for a time. And so to know that suffering is coming, to know that there are bad things on the way, is and to be told, well, get ready for it. And you get ready for it by making sure that you know the truth and you're going to hold fast to the truth and you're tied into God, so that when it comes, you can handle it. You can deal with it. And ask God for the strength that you need to be able to handle it, and to be able to endure whatever comes your way. And, you know, we've always thought of this as you look at the eras of the church, to a period of time where the church came under persecution for a period of time. And, you know, and as you look at the Roman emperors and how that played out, they did suffer at the hands of the Romans for a period of time. And so he tells them, do not fear any of those things which you're about to suffer, but he says, be faithful until death. Wait a minute, I thought we were going to be thrown in prison. And he's obviously saying, it's not going to just end with prison. Some of you are going to have to be faithful unto death. That's what's coming. That's what's coming. So you're going, you know, they're going to have to overcome here. They're going to have to overcome this adversity and this challenge. And he says, if you are faithful until death, I will give you the crown of life. I will give you the crown of life. And so that's, you know, you're going to have to overcome. You're going to face terrible adversity here. Not because you've done anything wrong, but because you've been faithful. And I have to know where you're at in the faith. And to a degree, as I was reading this and thinking about it, I think, you know, we're on the brink of such a time. How close, I don't know. But you're on the brink. You can see the trends in society where you're going to stand out, and adversity is going to come our way as the society moves further and further from God. It says, so we're going to have to, whatever tests are coming our way, then we must be ready. And the letter is not only addressed to the people of Smyrna, that particular city, but to that era of the church, and it's addressed to us. Because it tells us, you know, that he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So this message is something we should heed as well. But he says, if you will be faithful unto death, I will give you the crown of life. Now, as you think about the crown of life, it's mentioned a number of times. It is one of the rewards of the overcomer. And it's mentioned the crown of life, and is mentioned several times in the New Testament. If you keep your finger there and go back to James chapter 1, we'll just look at a few places where it talks about the crown of life. James chapter 1. James chapter 1, verse 12. It says, blessed is the man who endures temptation, or testing. Blessed is the man who endures testing. And we are all tested, will we endure the test? For when he has been approved, that is, he has met the test, and as he's met the test and approved, that is, has God's favor and God has said, well done, as he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. So what this tells us, as we saw with Smyrna, for us, we have to be faithful to the end. And as we are faithful to the end, it says that the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. We love him enough to keep his commandments to the end. And if pressure is brought to bear upon us to not keep his commandments, to compromise with the commandments, no, we love God and we will keep his commandments. We're not going to give in. You know, it makes me think of the Tom Petty song, you know, I won't back down. You can stand me up against the gates of hell and I won't back down. So, anyway, you won't back down. I know the truth. I'm going to hold to the truth. So do what you got to do. So whatever it is, I'm not going to enjoy it, but I'm not giving in. And you can't. So as you are faithful, you will receive the crown of life. 2 Timothy chapter 4 speaks of the crown of life. Paul says that I've finished the race. I've run my race and I've finished. And what awaits for me is the crown of righteousness. The crown of righteousness awaits me. But the critical thing is he finished the race. And Paul went through all sorts of ordeals and trials and difficulties. And he stuck with it to the end. And he knew that when he wrote 2 Timothy that his life didn't have, there was not a lot of time left. And he was going to die, be executed, and he ultimately was. But he would not compromise with the truth. He said, I finished the race, and the crown of life, the crown of righteousness awaits me. Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 4, called it the crown of glory. The crown of glory. A glorious crown that we have been given. And one other scripture where the crown is mentioned is in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 25, where it talks, says that the crown goes to the victor. It goes to that person who is going to hold fast to the truth and will not compromise with the truth and is victorious. You know, you're going to finish the race. You're running until you finish. Now, as you think about this crown, you know, as you look at crowns, you have various types of crowns that are available. And one of the crowns is called, in Greek, is diadema. It's a diadem, as we would say it in English. And that's the type of crown that has the different points on it. The crown that you commonly see kings wearing. But it's not, that's not the crown that's being referred to here. The crown that they're referring to is the crown that's, is Stephanos. Stephanos, which is the crown of victory. And it's the crown that was given to the victor at the various games that were held in the Greek-speaking world. For instance, in Smyrna, they had games that were famous all over Asia. They were similar to the Olympic Games, and those games were given to the victor in a particular event. And what they were was a wreath, a laurel wreath that was put on the head. That was the victor's crown. So you were striving, as you entered a contest or a race, you were given the victor's crown. And the Christian can win the crown of victory in the contest of life. And as we receive that crown, it's not because we've beat anybody else out. Our race is not against anybody else. Our race is, we're in the race alone. And God is only going to measure how we do and how, whether it doesn't matter what other people do. We're running our own particular race, and our goal is to finish that race and to meet the test that God gives to all of us. And it doesn't matter what anybody else does. Some will do better, some will do worse. But their measure is Christ and his law. And he's looking at how, whether we meet the test, whether we hold fast. And I'd say that's a pretty big test when you're in Smyrna and you're told, hey, bad things are coming. Some of you are going to be thrown into prison, and some of you are going to be challenged with death. I'd say I'd be kind of worried about that. And some of the things I worry about now would seem pretty small when you're looking at that. But God commended them. God said that they would receive the crown. As you go back and look at the ancient Greek world, when a man faithfully performed the work of a magistrate, at the end of his term in office, he was granted a crown. He was granted a crown. And the lesson for us is, as we are faithful in our duties and responsibilities as Christians, then we will be given a crown. As we faithfully serve Christ and our fellow men, that crown awaits us. That crown awaits us. The heathen world was in the habit of wearing crowns or chaplets of flowers at banquets. And interestingly, aren't we invited to the greatest banquet that will ever take place? Aren't we invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb? And everybody that will be at that supper, every last one of them who will be there, will receive that crown. Every last one of them will be there because they have met the test and they have been invited to that great banquet. And everybody that will be there from Christ on will have finished that race. And they will have been victorious. And they will receive that crown and be a part of that great banquet that we've been invited to. As you looked at heathen worshipers in ancient times, they were in the habit of wearing these crowns when they approached the temples of their gods. And you know, we will be able to one day be in the presence of God. We will enjoy His presence to come before Him. So we have the opportunity to have this crown. It's something that we look forward to. And, you know, it's a laurel crown. It's not gold or silver. It's laurel leaves, you know, all wrapped together. And, you know, it isn't of great value. But the symbolism is of great value because it's something that Christ is going to give to you and me. And we can be there and we can be a part of what God is doing. And he goes on here to say, as he goes on in Revelation chapter 2, he tells them to listen up to what he has to say. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And he says, he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. So what is the second death? What is the second death? William Barclay says in his commentary, he says, the second death is a mysterious phrase which occurs nowhere in the New Testament outside the Revelation. That particular phrase is not mentioned anyplace else in the New Testament. There are allusions to it, especially in Hebrews chapter 6 and Hebrews chapter 10. But it doesn't use that particular phrasing, the second death, in those locations. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 20. Revelation chapter 20, where it speaks of the second death. Revelation chapter 20, verse 6. It says, blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power. So this would tell me that the people that are being spoken of here, that are not going to be subject to the second death, they're going to be a part of this first resurrection. It says, blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. That means they're going to reign with Christ. The second death has no power over them. That means they can never die. They've been given eternal life. Now, it's mentioned in verse 14, the second death. It says, then death and Hades, or the grave, were cast into the lake of fire. That is the second death. So the second death is associated with the lake of fire. Now, as you think about that, what is death? What is death? Death is the cessation of physical life. Isn't that right? Death is the cessation of physical life. And if you're going to die the second death, that means you're going to have to be alive again. Isn't that right? So if you were alive once, you're going to have to be alive again. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27. Hebrews 9, verse 27. It says, but speaking about sinning willfully, after we have received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. So the sacrifice of Christ, if you reach the state, the sacrifice of Christ no longer applies, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment, the final judgment, the final condemnation and fiery indignation, which will devour the adversaries. Speaking about this judgment to come. And we know that the Bible tells us it is appointed to men once to die. It is appointed to men once to die, and after this, the judgment. So we all die we'll all die physically. Our physical lives will come to an end. And after this, the judgment. And the Bible tells us that there will be a second resurrection, so there will be people that will be in the grave, and they've rejected God and have not responded to God for one reason or another, and they will come up to a physical life and they will die the second death. But these people that have been called and converted and God has worked in, those individuals will not be subject to the second death because they will be given eternal life and they will be a part of God's kingdom forever. So this the third resurrection, we don't want to be a part of. And the Bible indicates that there will be a first resurrection that those in this age who have been faithful will be a part of. All of those who are Christians. And then those who have not known God and not been called by God, they will come up in the second resurrection. And the third resurrection will be those individuals who have had their opportunity and rejected it for one reason or another. They have chosen to follow the course of sin or selfishness and or given in to fear or whatever it may have been, but they've refused to allow God to complete His work in them. And so then they will suffer the second death. So the people that are being spoken of here will not be subject to the second death. They will be a part of God's family forever. And as you think of the number of people that are going to be part of the first resurrection, it's really a small number. Think about the first 2,000 years. Okay, the time from Adam until the flood. Basically 2,000 years. How many people can you name that are going to be a part of the first resurrection? Abel, Enoch, Noah. That's three people. Now, there may have been others. I can't say that's the definitive number. But the Bible doesn't reveal that there were a lot of people that made it during that period of time. So for the first 2,000 years, you have a very small number of people, maybe only three. It certainly doesn't tell us that Shem, Ham, and Japheth made it, or their wives. Even Noah's wife. Maybe she did, maybe it didn't, but she's not mentioned. And you go on from the time of the flood down to the time of the coming of Christ, how many people made it? The Bible doesn't tell us everyone, but it's a fairly small number. And then after Christ's coming, the number of people that have the opportunity to be a part of the first resurrection expands because God is allowing people from all nations and all peoples to be a part of the church. But it's still going to be a fairly small number. Look at the numbers that have survived, since Herbert Armstrong, since 1934, how many people have been in the church and have been faithful to the end? How many of us are there left? So, it's not, we're not going to have a billion people coming up in the resurrection when Christ returns at the seventh trump. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands, but millions, I'd be surprised. But it will be those people that God has developed and perfected, and the second death will have no power over them. Now we'll move on to the next church, which is Pergamos or Pergamum. Sometimes you'll see it spelled with an O-S, Pergamos or Pergamum. Both, it means the same thing. They're found also in Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2, and let's begin in verse 12. And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, "These things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword." He has the sharp two-edged sword. Again, he says, "I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is." So Satan had a very powerful presence in the city of Pergamum. Had a very powerful presence there, and even with his powerful presence, there was a church there. God raised up a church in the city of Pergamum. And it is interesting, as I've said before, as you look at the fall of Babylon, the Chaldeans, the religious leadership, they survived and they moved on. And they moved to the city of Pergamum. And they established their religion, carried their religion there, and they were accepted there and were very influential there. And then there came a point in Pergamum's history when the king no longer said, basically, his life was coming to an end, and he willed the city of Pergamum to the Romans. And it was at that time that the Chaldeans moved on to Rome and became very influential there. And that's why you can see the Chaldean influence in the Babylon mystery religion that unfolded there in the city of Rome. But they moved from Babylon to Pergamum and on to Rome, and were very influential with people, with the church in Rome at as things unfolded. So these people in the church, they were there where Satan's throne is, and he says, "You hold fast to my name, and do not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you where Satan dwells." So to live in a city where Satan dwells, Satan is your adversary. Satan is the one who's dedicated to your downfall. He hates God and he hates the church. He hates it and the people in the church. And so Satan is is chomping at the bit to have an opportunity to come after the church. And it appears that God allowed Satan to come after the church to some degree. And there was a person by the name of Antipas who was a faithful martyr unto death. He was killed among you where Satan dwells. Verse 14, he says, "But I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality." So Balaam was an individual who, for personal gain, was willing he would have happily cursed Israel. He wouldn't have had any qualms about it because he was getting paid. So as long as I'm paid, I'll just say, what do you want me to say? I'll curse them any way you want. And he was happy to do it. But God said, you can't do it. In fact, when he did speak, he pronounced blessings on Israel. So God was not going to allow him to curse Israel, even though he really wanted to. But you see, Balaam was a very creative individual. And he said, "All right, now I can't directly go against God. I cannot directly go against him, so I've got to find some way, I've got to find a workaround in order that I can get all the goodies that you're promising me." So he said, "Now, I can't curse them, but what you can do is you can cause them to bring a curse on themselves." And that's exactly what he did. He said, send your young women out to the Israelites, and young Israelites, like young women, whether they're of a different group or not, they don't really care. Hey, these are good-looking girls, and you know what? These girls want to have fun, and we're excited about having fun with them. And and if we have to get involved with their religion some to have fun, then let's do it. And they did. And they brought a curse on themselves. And yes, they did work around what God told them, but Israel brought a curse on itself. But that's how Balaam worked to be able to get what he wanted. He was more than willing to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, cause them to trip. And he was more than happy to do that, to get them to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality. And unfortunately, the church had allowed this kind of a mindset to become acceptable in the church, to begin to compromise with the truths of God. And then it says, "Thus you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate." Someone asked me here in between services about the Nicolaitans, and I don't have a lot of details about that because that's not what I'm focusing upon this particular time. But they had this that those who have the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, and that doctrine was a destructive path to follow, and it had gained influence in the church. And we tended to associate it with lawlessness because as you go back and look at some of the things Paul said, he said that the mystery of iniquity, the mystery of lawlessness is already at work in the church. And they were promoting that in an organized way. He goes on to say in verse 16, "Repent or else I will come to you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth." Repent or else I will come quickly and fight against them. Those who have compromised with the truth. Verse 17, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat." I will give him some of the hidden manna to eat. It goes on to say that not only will he give him of the hidden manna to eat, but I will give him a white stone. A white stone. And on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. So today we're going to focus on the hidden manna. We're not going to focus on the white stone. That'll have to wait till next time. Believe it or not, there's enough to talk about and we'll focus more on the white stone next time. But the hidden manna, you know, what does that relate back to? We're well aware that it relates back to when Israel had left Egypt and they were in the wilderness and they didn't have food to eat. And so God provided for them. God provided the bread from heaven, which is called manna. And manna ceased being given when Israel entered the land of Canaan. There was no more manna. There was no longer a need for it. But there was some manna that was preserved, and that was preserved in the Ark of the Covenant. Early in the 6th century B.C., the temple which Solomon had built was destroyed. And the rabbis had a legend that when that happened, Jeremiah hid a pot of manna in a cleft in Mount Sinai, and that when the Messiah came, he would return and the pot of manna would be discovered again. That's a legend. Who knows if that's true or not? To a Jew, to eat of the hidden manna meant to enjoy the blessings of the Messianic age. It was symbolic of that Messianic age to come. To a Christian, it meant to enter into the blessedness of the new world which would emerge when the kingdom came. And we are able to, you know, we understand by partaking of the Passover and the days of unleavened bread and those kinds of things, we understand that that manna is available to us. Christ is the bread of life. He is that bread from heaven which we can enjoy and ensure that we will grow and mature in the faith. John tells us that when the Jews said to him that their fathers had eaten manna in the wilderness, so receiving bread, then Jesus said, what? I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life. And if the hidden manna and the bread of life are the same, the hidden manna is the bread of life symbolized by the bread we eat on Passover. And continuing to overcome and partake of that bread leads to eternal life. Now, we're going to take a little bit of a detour here and think about the tree of life and the hidden manna and the Ark of the Covenant for a little bit as we between now and 5:30. So we've talked about the tree of life last time when we were talking about the Ephesus church. And this time we're talking about the hidden manna. And with those two items in mind, we might ask, do the tree of life and the hidden manna have anything to do with the Ark of the Covenant? Do those two things have anything to do with the Ark of the Covenant? We discussed the tree of, as I said, we discussed the tree of life last time, and we're looking at Pergamos now. So how would these tie to the Ark of the Covenant? Well, we know that the Ark of the Covenant was in the tabernacle and was in the Holy of Holies in the temple, God's personal room. And the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat and the lid where the blood of propitiation was sprinkled as a covering atop it. That's the Ark and that thing, that lid that was on top of it. But let's go to Hebrews chapter 9 and let's look at what was in the Ark of the Covenant. And what you realize here is that God recorded these things for a reason. He put these things into the Old Testament and has carried them forward into the New because they're important symbols and help us to understand certain things about His way of life. Hebrews chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Then indeed even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service and the earthly sanctuary. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. Behind the second veil, the part of the temple which is also called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer, the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory, overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail." So we see here that in the, as you look at the Ark of the Covenant, there are three, mentions these things in here. It mentions that there's the pot, golden pot with the manna. It speaks of Aaron's rod and the tablets of the covenant. Three things were in that. And you see where are they at? They're very closely associated with God's throne. Because symbolically, that's where God ruled from. So, you see Aaron's rod. Now, why was Aaron's rod there? Why did God say, put Aaron's rod into the Ark of the Covenant? It's biblical symbolism, which is given to help us to understand certain things, and He put them in there to help us to understand His purpose. And let's look at the rod a little bit here. Let's go back to Numbers chapter 16 and look at what took place right before that rod was placed into the Ark of the Covenant. Numbers 16, beginning in verse 1. "Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men." So the people that were involved in this rebellion against Moses and Aaron at that time, they were sons of Reuben. They were sons of Reuben, and Reuben was the first son, the firstborn son to Jacob. And I think, and even though they had been eliminated from the blessings that were to come to that firstborn son, born son because of Reuben's sin, they still chafed under that. We're the firstborn sons. We should be in the top position. "And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representative of the congregation, men of renown. These were the top men among the people of Israel, and they rebelled against the leadership of the church at that time, the congregation in the wilderness. Verse 3, they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So this was a two-pronged assault. One prong was against Moses, the other prong was against Aaron directly. And the people who were constituting the opposition actually got themselves together and they formed a conspiracy to overthrow Moses and Aaron. It says Korah was a Levite and his complaint was against Moses directly. The other men, who were all sons of Reuben, had in their mind that they should be leaders because Reuben was the eldest son of Jacob. And they felt that they had been unfairly dealt with and that Moses did not have a right to govern the body. So they said, "This is, you know, we feel this way. These are our thoughts." And then let's go down to verse 31, Numbers chapter 16, verse 31. So they had made their statement, and it says in verse 31, "Now it came to pass as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, with their households and all the men with Korah, with all their goods." They were all swallowed up and destroyed. But God was not done making his point. He goes on to continue. Obviously, he showed them, these people do not have my favor. And these all died as the earth opened up and swallowed them up. But he goes on to make further points in chapter 17. So let's look at beginning in chapter 17, verse 2. "Speak to the children of Israel and get from them a rod from each father's house, all their leaders according to their father's houses, 12 rods." So each of the tribes had a leader, and each of the leaders of the tribe had a rod representing their power and authority. And so they were to bring their rods and write each man's name on his rod. So write each man's name on his rod. "And you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi." So they wrote their names on the rods. "There shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. Then you shall place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Thus I will rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel which they make against you." So these were all rods, and they took and they carved the names of each of the head of each of the tribes into the rod, and they put them in the tabernacle of testimony. And they awaited to see what would happen. Who would God choose? Who would God show to be the one that he confirmed as the head? Let's go down to verse 8. "Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds, had produced blossoms and yielded ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put their complaints away from me, lest they die.'" So God made it very clear by this miracle that took place here, causing this Aaron's rod to bud, to show who he was in, who was in charge, who he was backing. Very clearly, Aaron was the one that he chose. And Paul cites this in the New Testament in Hebrews 9, which we've already looked at. Now note what kind of how did it bud? What kind of branch and what did that branch produce? It produced almonds. It produced almonds. Now is that significant? We'll see. So as you look at these rods. You know, as you look at that, the Hebrew word rod has several applications. appearing fairly often in the Scriptures. It translated as staff when walking is indicated. It's translated as lance when you're using it for fighting. It's used as a scepter when ruling is indicated. For instance, these were the heads of the tribes, and to have this rod represent your rule. You were the ruler of that tribe. Or rod as in chastening or giving direction. So, you know, it had various uses and various representations. So Aaron's rod has quite a history, and as you go back to Exodus 7, that rod was always present when each of the plagues unfolded. It was there, and it was all part of what took place. The symbolism, that particular almond rod represented the authority and power of God. That's why it was put in the ark in the Holy of Holies. It represented, it symbolized God's authority and power presented before all Israel's eyes. And keep that, and as I said, keep in mind, it was an almond rod. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to Exodus chapter 25 and look at something interesting about the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 25. Exodus chapter 25, beginning in verse 31. So God's giving instructions about the construction of the tabernacle. He's very specific. He gave this understanding to Moses, and Moses did a very good job. Was very diligent in carrying out what God wanted him to do. And that's where the people who made the implements and things of the tabernacle were inspired by God to get it right, to do it in the way, to be able to envision it and to get it right the way that God wanted it done. Let's look at Exodus 25 and let's look at verse 31. It says, You shall also make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand shall be of hammered work, its shaft, its branches, its bowls, its ornamental knobs, and flowers shall be of one piece. And six branches shall come out of its sides, three branches of the lampstand out of one side, and three branches out of the lampstand on the other side. And so you have one central branch which goes up in the middle, and on the sides you have three branches on either side. You know, we would recognize this as a menorah, the lampstand that was up inside the tabernacle in the temple. It says, three bowls shall be made like almond blossoms on one branch, with an ornamental knob and a flower, and three bowls made like almond blossoms on the other branch, with an ornamental knob and a flower, and so for the six branches that come out of the lampstand. And on the lampstand itself, four bowls shall be made like almond blossoms, each with its ornamental knob and flower. Now, as you look at that, is that telling us anything? Let's go down to verse 40. It says, and see to it that you make them according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. Make it according to that pattern. So, as we think about this, remember the pattern came from heaven. And this is the fabled lampstand, the menorah. However, it was a great deal more decorative than just a mere candelabra. It was constructed not of multiple parts, but of one single solid unit with seven bowls featuring the design of an almond tree in full bloom. So, what's inside the ark? Aaron's rod, and how did that bloom? It bloomed with the almond branch and the almonds. And so that's right there by God's throne, and then right close to God's throne on the other side of the curtain is the menorah, which is also what? Symbolic of an almond tree. So the surface symbolism is probably this. The almond was the earliest bloomer of the fruit trees in the Jerusalem area, and thus was a symbol of new life each spring. However, the symbolism goes deeper and is far more significant than that. A man by the name of Leon Jardine, who has no connection with the Church of God, did a great deal of research and offered a book titled The Tree of Light. And Jardine's research led him to conclude that the seven-bowled menorah, with its almond tree design, symbolized what? It symbolized the tree of life. So you probably wondered, well, what tree was it in the garden? You know, was it the apple tree? There was no apple tree associated with the Garden of Eden. Was there probably, you know, there at God's throne? There may have been one in the garden. Surely there was. But it's not the tree of life. So we have two very significant pieces with almond tree association within the tabernacle and temple. First, the lampstand with its almond tree motif giving light in the holy place, the first room. And the second, Aaron's almond tree rod that miraculously budded and produced fruit overnight within the Ark of the Covenant itself, representing God's authority and power. So consider the seven-branch menorah formed according to the pattern of an almond tree gave light in the holy place and symbolized the tree of life. In addition, Aaron's almond rod that budded and was placed in the Ark of the Covenant right in the Holy of Holies. And both of these symbolize salvation by grace and new life, indeed eternal life, by and through the Messiah and his sacrifice for sin. So is God showing us that, in a symbolic way, that the literal tree of life in the midst of the garden was an almond tree? Is that absolutely certain? It makes sense to me, but we don't know. We'll know someday. But the fact that you have an almond tree associated with God's throne and right there close to his throne would tend to lend some credence that very possibly it was an almond tree. Just something to think about. So as you're eating almonds, which are good for you, think of maybe that was the tree that was there in the Garden of Eden, that was accessible to Adam and Eve to eat of symbolically, accepting God's way of life. What was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? I don't know. It doesn't tell us what tree that was, but it does give us some indication that the tree of life may very well be an almond tree. And God's very specific. He doesn't say it's just a tree. He doesn't say it's a peach tree or an apple tree or any other type of tree. He says it is an almond tree. That's what is closest to his throne and may very well be that tree that was symbolic of what God was working out. And so that's a little bit of tidbit. You know, as you're drinking a beer with somebody and talking about the Bible, yeah, let me tell you this story. So anyway, interesting. Now you have that other pot that is the hidden manna, which was also in the ark. And we know from the book of Exodus that manna was given to Israel to sustain them through the wilderness. And it tells us that we're able to eat of the hidden manna. We're able to eat of it. The miraculous food from heaven kept Israel alive and energized them physically. Their 40 years in the wilderness and it did not cease falling each morning until they came into the land. They were to go out and gather up that manna 6 days. 5 days they were to gather an amount that they needed for the day. And on the sixth day they were to gather a double portion. And on that sixth day when they gathered it, it did not begin to stink and to develop worms and all of that. And let's go to John chapter 6 where Christ brings this forward. John chapter 6. And Christ very clearly ties this in with the manna in the Old Testament. What was taking place with Israel in the wilderness was symbolic of all of us today and what has been made available to us. It says in verse 30, "Therefore they said to him, 'What sign will you perform then that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate the manna in the desert, and it is as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat.' Then Jesus said to them, 'Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. That was just a type. My Father gives you the true bread. He makes the true bread available to you. For the bread of God is He who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And he goes on down in verse 35, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. So Christ is the bread of life, the bread from heaven. And one of the impressive things about manna is that they were told to gather what they needed for the day, not to leave, get any extra. And, you know, they did. I'm sure there were some people who didn't, and I'm probably sure they had some stinky stuff in their tents that the next day when they said, well, who's going to know? We'll gather a little extra here, no problem. And sure enough, it went bad on them. And Aaron was told to put an omer of manna in a golden pot and put it inside the ark. And he put it inside the ark, and it never stank once for 1,000 years. You might think about, was somebody watching over that pot? Never did stink. Absolutely, since it represented Jesus Christ and the life that he could give us. He never wears out. He is the bread that we are to eat. And manna strengthened the Israelites so that they could do things on God's behalf and complete the journey to the promised land. And God says to all of us that if we are overcomers, then we will be able to eat of the bread of life. We will be able to eat of that hidden manna. So what God has done for you and me is He has made the tree of life available so we can eat of it. We can eat those almonds off the tree, figuratively speaking, and we can eat of the hidden manna. God has made provision for us. And Christ is the bread of life. So we see the things that were in the Ark of the Covenant with its mercy seat, signifying the throne of God and His presence, the golden pot of manna, signifying Jesus Christ, our Savior and High Priest at His right hand. And the almond, Aaron's almond rod that miraculously budded, signifying the tree of life, God's power and authority. And you notice there are three things in that ark. We're not going to be able to talk about the third one today. We'll do that next time. But the thing is, they tie into Jesus Christ. And there's a threefold, there's this one statement that is made there that ties into all of this, which we'll talk about next time. And what is the white stone? What does that symbolize? We'll talk about that next time. And in the meantime, you can look it up or think about it or send me questions or whatever, but we'll talk about that next time. And next time, we will be meeting early on August the 3rd. That's the next time we'll have the services and Bible study. So we'll be meeting at 10:30 that day for services. And then we'll take a short break. We won't have finger foods, but we will have we'll have Bible study, and we'll get into that subject of finish up what the third thing that was in the ark, and also we'll talk about the white stone.